From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Legend has it that salamanders are born in fire and that they have magical abilities to renew and nourish themselves in flames. Real salamanders are none too fond of fire, but they do have amazing abilities to renew and regenerate themselves. So this week on Science Out of the Box, why can salamanders regrow limbs? And why can't we? David Gardner is a research biologist at the University of California, Irvine. His specialty is regeneration, and he joins us from member station KUCI in Irvine. Thanks for joining us, David Gardner.
My pleasure to be here.
So I guess the first and most obvious question is, do we know how salamanders regrow their limbs?
Well, if we knew how to do that, we'd be knowing how to regrow our own limbs. So the simple answer is no. But we know a lot about it, and we're learning more all the time.
So what do we know? I mean, what do you do in the lab?
Basically, we cut off arms and watch them grow it back. But seriously, we actually do know how they do it, which is you cut off the arm, or they lose an arm. Somebody eats their arm, something like that. The cells that are left behind have the ability to go back to what they were doing back when they were in the embryo.
So they become sort of stem cells, sort of?
Yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of that. So you look at a salamander, you cut off its arm and it grows back and you go, wow, that's great. You know, it can do it and we can't. And so we have the sense that we can't regenerate. And that's not true. We can regenerate the epidermis on our skin mm-hmm. and our bone regenerates and nerves can regenerate and blood vessels can regenerate. But we don't seem to be able to coordinate that into making a complex structure that contains muscles and bones and skeleton.
So have you put your finger on a conductor in the salamander?
Yeah. So in the salamander, it's these are the cells that make up what we call the connective tissue. These are actually the cells that allow us to hold together, that in the salamander are the ones that have information about where, you know, what's the top of our hand and the bottom of our hand and the tips of our fingers and our shoulder. I mean, there's a reason that we look the way that we do. And these are the cells that have that kind of the blueprint. So in the salamander, they're the ones that control regeneration. But in a human, we have these same cells, but they have a different response to injury. And these are the cells that make scars. And so that's really what we're focused on, is that a salamander doesn't make a scar. So it's as if there's two different ways things can go in response to injury. You can either make a scar or you can regenerate.
Huh, cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's actually pretty exciting.
Does this mean that with your research as a basis, we may not have the problem of missing arms and legs anymore? We may be able to regrow arms and legs and even organs and things?
Well, I'd like to think that. This much I do know. Eventually, we will be able to do that. The evidence is overwhelming that there will be a time, it's unclear when that time will be, that will, in fact, be, we have this intrinsic regenerative ability. We will figure out how to tap into and regulate it, and we will be regrowing body parts, including organs, not just arms and legs.
So, David Gardner, why can't we humans do this?
Well, I think that is the important question, which is, why have we not evolved the ability to regenerate?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to assume that it's because there's something else about regenerating that is really, in an evolutionary sense, was not adaptive. So regeneration is obviously adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose an arm, obviously it would be a great advantage to be able to grow it back. But not if something else happens that kills you long before you have the opportunity to grow the arm back.
Right.
The arm won't do you any good. And so our thinking about that is it almost certainly has to do with wound healing. Salamanders heal their wounds very differently than a mammal does. They do it very rapidly. There's very little bleeding. If you cut off the arm in a mammal, you know, the animal would bleed to death within minutes. So it's something like that. And then it raises issues about how we respond to infection. And so I think you can make a case for why it would be very hard for a mammal in the wild during the course of evolution to evolve the ability to regenerate. And in fact, what they do is we have to close our wounds in a way that prevents us from dying from infection and bleeding to death. But in doing that, it probably doesn't allow us to regenerate.
David Gardner is a research biologist at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks very much.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Now that we know how an iPod's shuffle function works, and you took notes, right? We offer a bit of insight into the power of iPod marketing. A new study indicates that the logo on Apple products like iPods, iPhones, iMacs stimulates your brain. The study found that people who were shown the Apple logo scored higher on a creativity test than those who were exposed to the IBM logo, presumably because they were mirroring the traits they associate with those logos. Professor Gavin Fitzsimmons of the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University co-wrote the study on logos and the brain. He joins us now from Durham, North Carolina. So, Professor, tell us, what exactly were the traits that people associated with Apple and with IBM?
People find that when they think about the Apple logo, they think very strongly about associations with creativity. When they think about the IBM logo, they think about the general notion of competence or professional.
So the people you studied actually took on traits that they associated with these brands? I mean, the Apple creative ones began humming new compositions and the IBM ones got organized and competent?
Essentially, yes. We showed people on the computer for very, very short durations, like 30 milliseconds, either the Apple logo or the IBM logo. And then we looked at their behavior to see if, as you say, they hummed compositions or not. The Apple Prime people were much more creative than the IBM Prime people by like 20 to 30%.
This is a tremendous advertisement for Apple. Are they involved in this project at all, like funding it?
No, not surprisingly, many people ask me that question, but no, to ensure sort of the integrity of the project, we've never actually even spoken to anyone at any of the companies whose logos we use.
Huh. What do you think the message is for consumers, Professor?
We're obviously being influenced by the things around us, and so we should be somewhat wary of what's around us. And then we should be strategically surrounding ourselves with logos that have associations that we find to be desirable.
Hmm. And what's the implication for advertisers then?
If every time you see an Apple logo, you find yourself being more creative, you're going to be a little happier in all likelihood.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I think at a non-conscious level, we as consumers will start to pair the brand that we're being exposed to with this increased happiness. And that should, you know, result in some increase in loyalty from their customers, I would imagine, over time.
Thanks very much. Gavin Fitzsimmons is a professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. His study of the impact of logos appears in the April issue of the Journal of Consumer Research. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan.
This is NPR News. On a concert stage, under the bright lights, in their smart tuxedos or long black gowns, you don't tend to think of musicians as athletes. But they are. As Leon Fleischer, one of the finest pianists of his generation, likes to point out, musicians are athletes of the small muscles. And when a musician's muscles are damaged through overpracticing or too many performances or poor posture or, the injuries can threaten their careers. Leon Fleischer learned that bitter lesson 4 decades ago. His daughter Leah teaches that lesson these days to other musicians.
Good, and let's put your feet up on the bar.
At her physical therapy studio in Washington, D.C., surrounded by the mats, pulleys, and machinery of her ministrations, Leah Fleischer helps musicians avoid the terrible price her father paid at the peak of his career, when the fingers of his right hand began quite involuntarily to curl up. Leon Fleischer lost the use of his right hand.
Having spent 35, 36, 37 years of playing two hands, and then to have it denied for me was an enormous blow.
Leah was just 4 when Leon's right hand froze. She grew up under the shadow of her father's devastating injury.
There was all this promise for his life and career that was just never fulfilled. So it was a personal and family tragedy is what it was.
Now, more than 40 years later, Leah Fleischer has fashioned a career that combines music and muscles. She's a licensed physical therapist and Pilates instructor. Her clients include a number of professional musicians.
When I came to Lea, I couldn't play anymore.
Holly Hamilton is a first violinist with the National Symphony Orchestra. She's been coming to Lea Fleischer's studio once a week for the past 8 years.
I mean, how many occupations are there where you use your chin?
When she first met Lea Fleischer, Hamilton was suffering such debilitating neck and shoulder pain that she'd had to stop performing.
I mean, I went to so many doctors and therapists and chiropractors, and I got injections, I got all kinds of advice, which didn't work. And then finally, at the bottom, I just thought I couldn't play anymore, and then I discovered Lea.
Lea Fleischer says of all professional musicians, it's the string players like Holly who have the highest injury rate. They play more continuously than the other musicians. A tuba player sits out most of a symphony. Violinists bow through every movement. Their necks start to hurt, their shoulders, not to mention their chins.
Violinists, they play very asymmetrically. Cellists have a lot of back problems and shoulder problems as well, and harpists, tendonitis, wrist problems.
All the injuries come from overusing certain muscles. So Lea Fleischer helps them strengthen various opposing muscle groups to balance their bodies.
Everything we do is in front of us, our shoulders, our head, everything perches forward. So a lot of the work with physical therapy and Pilates is about strengthening the back of the neck, the back muscles, the abdominal muscles to create a strong trunk and core support. Okay, Holly, let's do leg circles. So hold the straps, push off, and go ahead and reach all the way from your sits bones down through the heels, extend long. So you can see this really takes her out of her normal, her daily position of arms forward,
totally.
Shoulders rotated.
Yeah.
Now her back muscles are working to keep her shoulders nice and mm-hmm. back and open.
Do you have a performance tonight?
Yes, I do. It's a hard one. We're doing Heldenleben. So I'm very sore today from last night. So she'll stretch me out, and then I'll go do another one.
Holly Hamilton says she keeps coming to Lea to get fixed. Her neck is straighter, her pain is reduced, and there's another benefit.
I grew an inch after working with Lea. I was 5'3", and now I'm 5'4".
These days, Lea Fleischer says more musicians are developing injuries, even though we've become more exercise conscious and more aware of physical fitness.
But on the other side of that is there's more time in front of the computer, there's more time spent in an automobile, and so we're not as physically active in general.
With musicians, injuries tend to come not from a single incident, but from accumulated stress on certain muscles. Professional musicians may have begun studying and performing at an early age. When they hit their mid-30s, the injuries start popping up. Lea once worked with a concert pianist who had a herniated disc. He said he'd gotten hurt on tour lifting a heavy suitcase. But Lea Fleischer thought it was more complicated than that.
He would sit at the piano for 6-8 hours a day, not take breaks, and also his actual posture at the piano was contributing to what developed into an injury.
It was a relatively straightforward case, Fleischer says.
We really worked on stretching the tight muscles in his low back and strengthening his abdominal muscles.
The pianist recovered after just a few months. Stressed muscles, ruptured discs, tendonitis, repetitive motion injuries are not just 20th and 21st century curses. The 19th century German composer Robert Schumann developed a debilitating injury in the middle finger of his right hand when he was a young man, and he had to stop playing altogether. He didn't stop composing, though. This piece, Toccata in C major, Opus 7, is quite difficult, but it never involves the middle finger of the right hand. Maybe Schumann wanted just one piece that he could still play. After Leon Fleischer injured his right hand, he worked his way through all the piano literature for the left hand and then began commissioning pieces so he could keep performing one-handedly. Eventually, Fleischer was luckier than poor Robert Schumann. In the 1990s, he got Botox injections in his right hand, and he was able, tentatively, apprehensively, to return to the concert stage to play with both hands. But the 79-year-old Kennedy Center honoree is still not completely healed or safe from his daughter's sharp gaze.
I'm always nagging him to really work his posture, to strengthen his back. And I do this from time to time. I write out all the exercises with little stick figures, and he'll do it for a few days. And what can you do?
When she's not lovingly nagging her father or straightening out her professional musician clients, physical therapist Leah Fleischer makes her own music. She started studying the harp when she was very young. It's a family tradition. Her mother's mother was a harpist. Her uncle played harp with Toscanini's NBC Symphony and later the Chicago Symphony. One of Leah's brothers and her sister are professional concert harpists. Her sister-in-law, too. And talk about injuries. Those harpists aren't toting around little piccolos.
We have a long line of hernias. My grandfather, my uncle, my sister's husband, they all had hernias.
Leah Fleischer wisely brought one of her smaller, daintier harps to play for us. An accomplished amateur, she loves making music. Although, as a physical therapist, Leah knows enough to stop practicing the moment she notices her neck and shoulders getting stiff.
Hey ladies, ever felt your date was more octopus than man, arms everywhere? Well, female octopuses, maybe they feel your pain. A new UC Berkeley study on octopus mating habits has some surprising findings. Christine Hufford is the lead author of the UC Berkeley study. She observed the octopus's behavior firsthand while conducting research in Indonesia, and she joins us now from member station KAZU in Pacific Grove, California, and that's right near the Monterey Bay Aquarium, where she works. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'll tell you what piqued our interest. We read the press release that UC Berkeley sent out, and in the first paragraph it said that your research found at least one species of octopus, quote, engages in such sophisticated lovemaking tactics as flirting, passionate hand-holding, and keeping rivals at arm's length. Now, what did you observe?
Flirting really is, it's a type of courtship. The hand-holding is definitely a bit of a stretch, but it does look like it because when we look at the two individuals mating, we can see that there's one big long arm stretched in between them. And that looks like they might be holding hands, but what that actually is the male's specialized mating arm. One of his eight arms has a groove along the back that's used to pass sperm packets from his body to the female. And so by little waves of muscle action, almost like peristalsis in our guts, little sperm packets are passed from the base of the arm all the way to the tip into the female.
Now, you also observed male octopuses exhibiting what we might like to call macho behavior.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that males fight over females. They fight very intensely. We saw them strangling each other, so actually cutting off the flow of water over each other's gills. We saw them wrestling to the ground and rolling around on the bottom of the sea floor. These octopuses actually are able to drop their arms off the way a lizard does its tail. And what we found most surprising was that males have a trade-off. They can either be really choosy and find something that's really valuable and stick with it and keep at it, or they can spend their time actually looking for lots and lots of mates.
And so it's like being monogamous or playing the field.
Right. They will definitely spend most of their time with the big female. Once they find her, they'll stay with her as long as they can, and they don't go out seeking other females. But if smaller females happen to come across their path, they certainly don't turn down the chance to mate.
They're not stupid after all.
Exactly.
What I also was interested in in reading about your study was these so-called sneaker males. They moved in on unsuspecting conquests by masquerading as females?
It seems that these octopuses are able to tell each other's sex, so whether they're male or female, by the color patterns that they're showing. So the sneaker males, in order to mate, they actually showed the more female typical color, so the more camouflage coloring, rather than showing off the male typical coloring. And that allowed them to mate with females right in front of the males. But they also did other behaviors like hiding behind rocks and waiting for the big male to go away. And they were really just avoiding aggression any way they could.
Didn't want to lose an arm over it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why is this so surprising? Because a lot of animals exhibit these aggressive tendencies when it comes to mating. What were you surprised by when you observed the octopuses?
So many different animals fight over mates, but we were not expecting to see them in octopuses. People had generally thought that octopuses were solitary. And then after mating, it was just assumed that they went about their daily lives separately. It was also assumed that males didn't compete for females. And this really just turned those ideas upside down.
Christine Hufford, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Christine Hufford. She studies the mating habits of octopuses at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, and she joined us from member station KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. I'm a mating game.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In Oregon, archaeologists have found something they say is very exciting. 14,000-year-old fossilized excrement. Now, stay with me here. These coprolites, as they're called by the experts, are remarkable for several reasons. For one thing, they're older than most artifacts left by the earliest Americans. For another, they contain DNA. And that gives scientists a rare opportunity to learn about the people who left them behind. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Archaeologists knew about Oregon's Paisley Caves back in the late 1930s. They were shallow and were carved into a hillside by a prehistoric lake. Inside, animal bones and stone tools and other signs that humans camped or lived there. But in 2002, a team dug deeper and found what you might call pay dirt.
In the bottom of cave number 5, we recovered horse and camel bones and a coprolite, which produced human DNA.
Archaeologist Janice Jenkins from the University of Oregon says they eventually found hundreds of coprolites. 6 contained human DNA. What amazed him was how old they were, 14,300 years. That radiocarbon date is important because no one has been able to agree on when people came to the Americas. The earliest clear evidence is about 13,000 years ago, but it's mostly stone tools and butchered animal bones. These were left by the Clovis people, traditionally thought of as the first Americans. But nobody had human remains that old, no bones or teeth, says Jenkins.
We finally have human remains or cells, basically molecular evidence for human beings before the Clovis time, and they're basically the individual signature that they left.
And they left it at least 1,000 years before the Clovis people. And the DNA tells more. Eska Willerslev at the University of Copenhagen is the scientist who extracted the DNA.
Our result shows that the oldest evidence we have to date of human presence in North America is definitely of Native American origin.
Native American origin because the coprolite DNA shows certain genetic patterns called haplogroups by geneticists common to present-day Native Americans. These patterns are also found among certain people in Eastern Asia. That adds weight to the hypothesis that people first came here across the Bering Sea on a land bridge connecting the two continents. Jenkins says scientists are still teasing out more information from the fossil feces, not surprisingly, for example, what early American cuisine was like.
They certainly ate sage grouse and smaller animals. I think we've recovered some chipmunk bones from one of the coprolites.
Jenkins says there are residues in the coprolites from types of plants that still can be found near the caves.
So what we have are visitors coming for a short day doing some hunting and collecting. So they would have been looking out over a grassy plain, basically, with a pretty rich environment, probably a few trees here and there, junipers, some pine trees possibly, but mostly an open shrub and grassland.
There are some puzzles raised by the mix of coprolites in the cave bottom, however. Thomas Dillehay is an archaeologist at Vanderbilt University.
Some of them did not have human DNA, and others had canine, perhaps fox DNA. So those admixtures are somewhat problematic and need to be resolved in the future.
So there's a chance that the coprolites were left by canines, or at least contaminated by them. But Jenkins notes that some of the coprolites contain human hair and human proteins in addition to human DNA. He suggests that if they were left by dogs, then they were dogs that were eating humans, which doesn't change the conclusion that people lived and died there 14,300 years ago. With hundreds more coprolites to examine, genetics expert Eske Willerslev says there's lots they can still find out from the DNA.
We can actually investigate, you know, what was the diversity of the people, first people entering the Americas, how many different people were they, you know, how big was the population, how was the frequency of females versus males.
The research on the Paisley Caves coprolites appears in this week's issue of the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A small rural school in Michigan is going green thanks to the fact that it's one of the windiest places in the country. The primary school and the school superintendent's house are now getting their power from wind. And that's just the beginning. From member station WCMU, Amy Robinson reports.
The Laker School sits on a blacktop two-lane road out in the middle of what's called Michigan's Rural Thumb. The school is surrounded by wind turbines. Dozens of utility-scale turbines turn in the breeze. You might think even Don Quixote would appreciate these gentle giants if only he had attended Laker schools. The district is embracing renewable energy in a big way.
We've received biodiesel grants. We have received energy smart incentives. We've received recently a biomass grant.
Kathy Dickens is the junior high principal and by all accounts a skilled grant writer. 3 years ago, she got her first grant, more than $250,000, from the Michigan Public Service Commission. She purchased three large refurbished wind turbines to power the elementary school.
I knew that utility scale wind developers at that time were knocking on the doors of farmers. And I knew that, well, if they're interested in leasing land and they're interested in our wind, the school should look into harvesting that, you know, and save taxpayer dollars.
Today, wind largely powers the elementary school, but that's not all. The district also has a biodiesel processor, and this spring, high school students will start to press oil from soybeans and create biodiesel, giving them exposure to a new product that few have ever seen.
We're actually going to have like a pressing party, if you will, where we're going to get our sunflower seeds that we grew underneath the wind turbines, and we're going to get some soybean and we'll actually press so the kids can see it.
And waiting in the wings is the school's anaerobic processor, which breaks down biodegradable waste and uses the methane to produce power. As students wander the hallways of Laker Junior High, it looks like your usual mix of young teens, intent on knowing what everyone else is doing while feigning nonchalance. Here, blue jean-clad 13-year-olds are training for a future that looks decidedly green. Trevor Lewis is in eighth grade and already thinking about a green future.
That's going to be something in the next 10, 15 years as we're getting jobs. That's going to be a wonderful thing to go into. Being the cutting edge, and not very many people will be able to go into that. We'll be right in the first few, so it'll really give us a good opportunity.
Of course, that opportunity comes with a price. Laker schools would not have been able to go green without the help of grant funding, but now that they are, they're saving money. Since they've hooked up wind and solar to the district-owned superintendent's house, the electric bill there has been cut by three-quarters. Superintendent Bob Smith.
Well, the very worst month, and I put out a lot more than 2,000 Christmas lights, and I think the biggest bill has been $30 a month so far. On average, it's about $12 a month.
That's pretty easy to swallow.
It's pretty good, especially because my son made me inherit a parrot, so we have to use a lot more energy to keep that thing warm during the winter.
Affordable energy to keep parrots warm. Just another benefit of going green. Junior high principal Kathy Dickens says too many bright, promising students leave this county after graduation. If wind, sun, or even an anaerobic processor can provide future jobs, she'll keep writing grants to give students the training they need to be ready for green careers. For NPR News, I'm Amy Robinson.